Welcome to ICOSA's Driving Force Radio, where we discover what drives today's leaders. Now, here's your host, Jan Mazzotti.
Good morning, and welcome to Driving Force Radio, where we seek to discover each week what drives today's leaders. On today's show, we are talking with David Hill from Encana Natural Gas. And Kelly, this is going to be a really interesting show. Energy 101, we talk about all things energy, and whether that's domestic, whether that's international, whether that's energy security, or whether that's just our own regional energy production. It is always such a fascinating conversation, and today's going to be no different.
That's right. Today is such an exciting show, and I'm personally thrilled that Encana is on the show because, as you know, I founded the Women in Energy Networking Group in Colorado, and they've always been a huge supporter of women in energy. And so what it demonstrates is that they support the community, they support the employees within their company, and I'm just thrilled to have them on the show.
Absolutely, and they're doing some really interesting things. Encana Natural Gas is a subsidiary of Encana Corporation, which is a Canadian-owned energy producer, and Encana is really focused on growing the market for North American natural gas. And our guest today is David Hill, the Vice President of Natural Gas Economy Operations here in Denver. He works externally and internally to increase the use of natural gas in the power generation and transportation sectors. Welcome to the show, David.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Well, we are so excited to have you here. So tell us a little bit about Encana. I think listeners know Encana is here, but don't know exactly what it is you do. What is Encana about?
Sure. Our company really was founded about 10 years ago by a merger of two large producers. And so today we produce a little over 3 BCF, billion cubic feet of natural gas a day in North America. So we're probably the second largest producer of natural gas in North America. So we drill and complete wells and produce and sell gas into the market.
And can you tell us a little bit more about what your position is in Encana?
Yeah, we're a new group formed a couple years ago when we found, we really began to believe we found too much natural gas. We had this abundant story that you hear a lot in the press. We were part of that story. So our CEO was really thinking about what do we do with all this natural gas? Because right now, you know, we had a supply-demand balance. With a lot of natural gas, we're going to see the price come down. So what are the new uses we can find for natural gas in North America? So they created a team, which I'm part of, in the early part of it. We began to study the markets in North America to look at what are the new uses. Mm-hmm. How can we increase the use of natural gas here? So we studied power generation, industrial uses of natural gas, and transportation. Can we really use natural gas in our engines as a transportation fuel? So that team came together to study that and look about, come about advocating and talking about using natural gas. And then from there, we actually started using it in our own operations. You know, can we use it in our trucks? We're going to ask people to do this. Why not do it ourselves first?
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we began that journey, if you will, as a large fleet. We have about 1,500 vehicles in North America, and we're about a third of the way through converting those vehicles to natural gas. And when we started doing that, we came across what everybody asked. Well, where do I get my fuel?
Right.
Where are these stations? Are they public access? So we're in Colorado, we have several field offices, but there's no stations. So we had to begin to look at evaluating building CNG stations, compressed natural gas. So we did that. So to support our fleet, and then we made some of those public access. And then we looked at our supply chain, all the people that come out to our well sites every day, yeah, in trucks and cars and pickups and Class 8 trucks. Can they convert to natural gas? So we began to explore that and work with our vendors to convert. So some of our vendors are now doing that. And where are they going to get the fuel?
Right.
So we had to explore that as well. So now we're building compressed natural gas stations for our fleets and our supply chain, as well as liquefied natural gas stations. And then the third piece we looked at was what about our own operations? We consume a lot of diesel in drilling and completing natural gas wells and oil wells. So we began that journey as well, looking at our own uses of fuel. So today we have about 50% of our drilling rigs using natural gas as a fuel instead of diesel. And also our pressure pumping services, we're exploring ways to convert those engines out there that pump.
So, David, I guess, Mike, this is really a two-part question based on what you were just talking about. Talk a little bit about the differences between CNG and LNG, because I think listeners sometimes mix it up or don't quite understand. And then talk about what it takes to build infrastructure like you're talking about.
Sure, yeah. It's really important to understand the differences of compressed natural gas and liquefied natural gas. The industry, the natural gas vehicle industry, is really centered around compressed natural gas. So we take natural gas at ambient pressure and temperature and really simply compress it up into a gas and put it on board the vehicle in a tank. And those tanks are Department of Transportation certified, and they're typically stored at 3,600 PSI, pounds per square inch. So it's a cylinder full of natural gas that really equates to anywhere from 5 to 20 gallons equivalent of gasoline on the vehicle. These tanks are larger than our gasoline tanks. The fuel density of natural gas is about 20% that of gasoline. So it takes up almost four times as much space to get the same amount of fuel on board. So that's compressed natural gas. Really good for light duty, you know, cars and pickup trucks, as well as transit buses and refuse trucks, return to base type of vehicles. It's a really good substitution for gasoline. When we go into our Class 8 tractors and our larger fuel-consuming vehicles that have to store more fuel on board, putting that much compressed natural gas on board is hard. It takes up a lot of space, and it begins to add up a lot of weight to the vehicle. Mm-hmm. So now comes around liquefied natural gas, where we simply reduce the temperature of the natural gas from, again, its ambient state down to about minus a negative 260 degrees. And it just changes phase. It goes from a gas to a liquid. So we store it on our vehicles in a thermos bottle. Pretty simple, but simply okay. Elegant. So it's a thermos bottle that keeps that liquid cold. And so we can store twice as much fuel on board as CNG. So it's a more way to, it's a better way to put more fuel on board a vehicle with less weight. So that's typically used in our Class 8 trucks that run up and down the highway. And we also are using that on our drilling rigs and some of our pressure pumping services. That's the fuel that's used there. And then we're just now starting to fuel locomotives. So you think about locomotives burn diesel. And consume a large amount of fuel. So liquefied natural gas is a way to store more fuel on board. So there's a test going on in Canada today with CN Rail that we're providing liquefied natural gas to them to fuel their locomotives to test that technology. Mining trucks work as well. Yeah. And we're seeing a lot more marine vessels, ships. Ferries are really a good application. Internationally, there's 50 ferries running with liquefied natural gas. And in the U.S., there's several ferry companies in the Northwest and the Northeast really evaluating using natural gas in their operations. So we got compressed natural gas, just simply compress it up, and then we liquefy it, low temperature, and store it in a thermos bottle, and bring it out and fill the engine with that fuel.
So now we understand the differences between CNG and LNG. How do you get it? Yeah. It's not, you know, you were talking about this earlier, that you're looking at that infrastructure and building out that infrastructure, but what does that look like, and what are some of those challenges and some of those opportunities of building infrastructure for natural gas support here in the Rockies as well as the country?
Sure, yeah. So for compressed natural gas, a station, we're really looking at, we in Canada and the industry, look at co-locating natural gas stations with existing gas stations, gasoline stations, or truck stops. That's the best way, the best synergy is to co-locate them. So when you're coming in to fill up with gasoline, you could also fill up with natural gas, whether it's liquefied natural gas or compressed natural gas. Because we're using compression versus simply a pump to pump a liquid fuel, it's more expensive. So a CNG station can be anywhere from $750,000 up to $2 million to put that in place.
And just one pump, or like a whole island?
A whole island, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so you'd put an island in that could have two or three dispensers. Mm-hmm. So one dispenser, just fill up one vehicle at a time, might be a little less than $1 million. And then if you want to put a multi-lane fueling station, it could be up to $3 million. And that doesn't include the land, so you need to have that land on top of it. So it's a very expensive proposition.
Yeah.
So that's one of our challenges. So to have a payout, you know, to actually get your money back from that investment, you need a lot of throughput.
Yeah, right.
So you need a lot of vehicles coming through, or vehicles that use a lot of fuel initially. So stations aren't being built just randomly.
Because
they're not going to be used, and the investor wouldn't get his money back. So what we find to overcome that challenge is to work with fleets first. fleets consume a lot of fuel on a per unit basis, and typically they drive a route that comes back to base, or they don't get off their route very often. Mm-hmm. So fleets become what's called an anchor for these stations, an anchor tenant. And so you can put it behind the fence and make it a private station, mm-hmm. or you can put it outside the fence or at a corner and make it a public access. And then that's what we're doing. We're trying to make most of our stations public access to give the communities the option, the choice, to have this fuel if they want to in their vehicle. And then you think about that of capital investment, and then the vehicles. There's not a lot of choices for consumers. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's more choices for fleets, but less choices for you and I as a consumer right now. So we're working on that as well, trying to get more choices out there for the fleets and the consumers.
Well, and as you're talking about this, a number of things strike me about sort of our Rocky Mountain region, such a big oil and gas region, and in particular gas. It seems like so many benefits to the consumer. One, that you're keeping these market, now you're creating natural gas markets right here. One, you're reducing emissions by converting fleet vehicles, especially with the oil and gas operations, by converting equipment. And I know that there's been tremendous advances in the, you know, the compression engines and all of those, to like no NOx emissions, no mm-hmm. all of these things. And so can you just talk a little bit about how does this impact the consumer in a positive way?
Yeah. I mean, I think first is Colorado as an example. We produce about 4.3 billion cubic feet of gas a day in the state of Colorado.
4.3 billion?
Billion cubic feet, yeah. And so we're the sixth largest state, number six in the country in production. Most of that gas leaves the state. We only consume about 1.7 billion cubic feet a day in our homes, you know, in our industrial complexes, as well as generating electricity. So we are a net exporter of natural gas. So if we keep that gas in the state, we can generate more jobs by all the different ways to use that natural gas in the state, and more taxes, more revenues for the counties, the cities, and the state. So there's a net benefit right there, more jobs. So, and the second, as you alluded to, was the environmental impact. You know, in Colorado, in Denver, we're a non-attainment area for our particulate matter and our ozone. So if we use natural gas, we actually have less particulate matter coming out of our engines. We have less NOx, as you suggested. And we also have less volatile organic carbon. And those are precursors to the ozone that we see. So we look at California, all their transit buses and refuse trucks are all natural gas. They're trying to clean up the Los Angeles basin. So they're seeing great success with that. Right. And so natural gas can really benefit us environmentally here, right on the Front Range with our ozone, as we begin to transition our fleets to natural gas. And then the other is the economic benefit. It's a lower cost. You know, today oil is trading in the $90 a barrel range, and natural gas is trading less than $4 at MMBTU or 1,000 standard cubic feet. So there's quite a what we call spread between the price of oil and natural gas. It's beyond the spread of the energy. The energy trades at 6 to 1 on an energy equivalent is what it should trade at. And today it's trading at 25 to 1. So natural gas is a lower cost fuel today. So we're seeing it 20 to 30, 35% cheaper than gasoline and diesel at the pump today. Sure. So it's a good value proposition for economics as well.
Sure. Well, and we talked too, you mentioned this, but you know, obviously fleet vehicles are those first adopters, those early adopters of these natural gas solutions. But why are there less choices in vehicles? What are those trends that are making it where it's that cool thing to have a natural gas vehicle or a clean vehicle, but there really aren't a whole lot of solutions? What are the ways that Encana is working with the industries in vehicle production and things like that to get this out there? Because obviously if we're a huge producer at 4.3 billion cubic feet a day, it's cheaper and we're hovering around $3 a gallon again. Why can't we get more critical mass in this area?
Yeah, that's a great question. One is a lot of people don't know about it. That's the first part. As consumers and fleets, they just don't know they have a choice. They think they have to use gasoline or diesel in their operations. They don't know about that. So part of our program is really getting the message out and letting them know they have a choice. When we do go talk to our auto manufacturers in Detroit, we've been to talk to GM and Ford and Chrysler about the need for more American-produced vehicles that have alternative fuels. You know, we need more choices for consumers and fleets. We've been talking to them about almost 2.5 years. And part of that is what they tell us is they need to hear from the customer that they want this. They're willing to build it. They can build it. It's not that hard. So they're looking for the market pool, you know. So they don't want to build something and no one buys. So what we have done as a community of producers is tell them the type of vehicle we want. So we went to the three auto manufacturers and said we want a 3/4-ton pickup truck. We would like it bi-fuel that could use natural gas or gasoline because there's not a lot of infrastructure. So you can actually build a vehicle that can run on gasoline and you can push a button, simply push a button and it runs on natural gas or vice versa. It starts up on natural gas. If you run out of natural gas, it automatically switches to gasoline and you don't know the difference. You wouldn't know what fuel it's running on. So we asked them for a bi-fuel vehicle pickup truck. And that was four-wheel drive, extended cab, and this is what we use in our operations. And so several of them listened to us. So today, you can order from your dealer at Chrysler a Dodge 2500 heavy-duty bi-fuel pickup truck from the OEM that's fully warrantied, fully supported. And then the same with GM products. We can buy a Chevy and a GMC 2500 3/4-ton pickup truck from your dealer. You can order that, and that'll be fully warrantied and supported from your dealership. And Ford is working their way there. They're looking at the F-250. They've taken a different route where there's companies, and there's several of these in Colorado, that'll take a vehicle and simply upfit it with a system on top of the gasoline system. And that's how we've been doing it until this year. So now we can finally order vehicles from the dealership. So we're really excited. And now that's being offered for others. So the part of that equation is we got to buy them.
Yeah.
So our manufacturers know that they're there, that there's a market pool.
But at least there's this movement up the curve, up the bell curve towards adoption and getting to that next level of gaining critical mass in this area. That's fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, the other vehicle you can get, you know, is the Honda Civic natural gas. That's been around for 8 years. Mainly been sold as fleet vehicles, but in 2012 they modified the consumer vehicle for natural gas to make it more appealing, offer a few more options for you and I. And so that vehicle's out there today. And we have 8 of those running in our fleet in Denver and also in Texas, the Honda Civic. And that's a dedicated compressed natural gas vehicle. So there's more coming. We're seeing more and more coming and more options for us, but it's a little slower than we'd like.
Well, it's interesting to me because so I have kids in elementary school, and just the other day, mom stopped me and she said, "What do you feel about the production of natural gas?" And obviously, she knew my background; it wasn't just a random question. And I said, "You know, we need it, and we have the regulations to protect against impact to our environment, And so when I look at this transition, and I'm a huge supporter, and we've talked about this on the show a long time, of this transition in our transportation industry, that I really think that we need to transition away from gasoline and consider alternative choices. So, but when I look at the chain, I see a lot of areas of anxiety. One is production. One is, like Dan and I talk about, we need cars that carry a lot of equipment, chairs to sporting events and all of that stuff.
Kids in car seats.
Yeah, we need. And that's something I would have taken into account before I had kids. And so I just see a number of areas of anxiety along the sort of the supply chain. How is Encana looking at all of those? Are you looking at all of those along the chain, and what could we do to get the word out to address some of those points?
Well, absolutely. There is, again, a lot of it is just getting good information out.
Yeah.
So people are very, make them informed. They can make their own choices and their own determinations with the right information. So from a sense of the production side of natural gas and oil and gas in this country, you know, it's safe and responsible development. We've been doing it for several, I'll say over 100 years in this country. So we can do it. We have been doing it. It's letting people know what we do. And at our state level, the states really do have good rules and regulations, and Colorado leads that across the nation. So they've been very proactive protecting the environment and protecting us as consumers that live in our state. So we all enjoy the outdoors. I do too. And I want to make sure I continue to enjoy the outdoors. So getting that information out, letting people know, kind of getting over the hysteria.
Yeah.
You know, and putting the facts out there and letting people think about that and work on that. And then it's letting them know that natural gas is around you every day. You know, it's in our homes. You know, we cook with it, we heat with it, we heat our water with it. So we use it every day, and we're not uncomfortable with that. So why should we be uncomfortable with increasing the use of natural gas, you know, throughout our communities, whether it's in power generation? You mentioned school buses. They're a great application for alternative fuels. You know, propane is a great fuel for school buses, and natural gas is as well. Those school buses drive a route and come back, and all of our kids are in them. So why not have a cleaner fuel in there for school buses? So just letting people know that it's here, it's viable, it's sustainable, and it's economic, and it's a good fuel.
And is there the potential, what about looking at, instead of building out or in conjunction with building out the infrastructure, the pumping infrastructure, what about these technologies that you can put in your home and pump your own compressed natural gas?
Fueling, yeah.
Are those, that seems like a good option. I think we'd be to school on time a lot more often if I had that in my house.
That's a really good question. Home fueling for our vehicles, I think, is a trend that's going to come. Whether we have an electric vehicle and we plug in overnight, we have electricity in our homes, and we also have natural gas in our homes. So we're not plug into our natural gas line and fuel up overnight. So we're seeing that happening today. So there's a home fueler available on the market where you can install it, put it in your garage. It's code standards, right, like an appliance. You simply plug in. The problem is today it's expensive. So we as an industry are working, and as well as our federal government, the Department of Energy, is working on new home fueling appliances that are lower cost, that we can have it simply installed and plug in. So I think that's going to be a kind of a trend of the future, as we may be driving past gasoline stations on the corner, and you and those will be emergency fill-ups. Maybe fleets use those. But for you and I, whether we have an electric vehicle or a hybrid electric vehicle, or a hybrid gas, natural gas vehicle that is electric and natural gas, there's no reason we can't have a vehicle that's electric and natural gas. Why are we using gasoline in a hybrid vehicle? Why don't we use an alternative fuel?
That's
perfect
a good
sense to me. Electrification is a good way to go, but why not use our domestically produced fuels as the other fuel in the electric vehicle?
That is very interesting. You know, we talk about it as either electric or natural gas. We've never talked about it as a combination of the two.
If you look at us as consumers, change is tough for us.
Oh, it's very tough.
You talked about, I have four kids. I have to have a van. I don't want to lose the space in my van to the fuel.
Yeah.
So I want something that's integrated into my vehicle, that the transition to another fuel is seamless to you and I.
Yeah.
That's where we have to get to.
Yeah.
So I think hybrid vehicles, really plug-in hybrids that use electric and an alternative fuel, are going to be what we're looking for as consumers.
Well, David, I want to come back to some stuff that you talked about around infrastructure before we go to break. I know Encana's here in Denver, and a lot of this work is being done here in the Colorado region. But are you reaching outside of our borders? Are you working in these other states here in the Rockies? And then how many stations, what kind of infrastructure is Encana running right now?
Yeah. So we are. We're really reaching out across North America. So Encana is a founding member of America's Natural Gas Alliance, and I'm actually the chairperson of their Natural Gas Vehicle Committee. I'm also vice chairman of the U.S. Natural Gas NGV America, Natural Gas Vehicles for America. So I'm the vice chairman of that. So we have, through those committees and those organizations, definitely a broad reach across North America, talking to fleets and manufacturers about this solution. From Encana's perspective, we're definitely involved in everywhere we operate. We're looking at putting natural gas stations in and converting our fleet across our operations. So that's Louisiana, Texas, Wyoming, Colorado, all the way up into Alberta and into British Columbia. So today we have 6 natural gas CNG fueling stations. 4 of those are public access. We're building 2 more this year. One will be in Parachute. We have a large office in Parachute, so we're putting one right there. And we also have a permanent LNG station, a fixed LNG station in Louisiana, fueling some of our supply chain.
Uh-huh.
And we've kind of gone beyond that, as these fixed stations require a lot of throughput. So we've redesigned what's called a mobile fueling station. We call it MFS for short. We've got to have acronyms, right?
So you have to. Yes.
So this is actually a fueling station on wheels. And we put it on the back of a tractor trailer, and we can take it out to a location, set it down, and they can fill up trucks right there.
Oh, that's interesting.
So that helps fleets get started.
Sure.
It's a low-cost solution for them and for us as a fuel provider to get them kick-started. So we have, I think right now we have 10 of those in operation in North America.
Wow.
So that's for the trucks. And we took that the next step and created a system. We can actually take LNG out to a site and vaporize it, put it back into a gas state, and feed it into engines or into industrial uses for power. Or local distribution companies, our utilities, could, if they have a service disruption and they have to turn the tap off, on the other side we can pull this up and provide natural gas to a building or to
awesome.
A pipeline.
So that's awesome. Well, we have to run to break, but if you want to learn more, you can go to Encana.com. And when we come back, we'll have more with Kelly De La Torre of Rapid Tech Transit and David Hill, the Vice President of Natural Gas Economy Operations at Encana Corporation. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Driving Force Radio with ICOSA. Once again, here's your host, Jan Mazzotti.
Welcome back to Driving Force Radio. Today on Energy 101, my co-host is Kelly De La Torre from Rapid Tech Transit, but we're having this fantastic conversation around natural gas production and natural gas implementation and infrastructure here in the Rockies as well as in North America, Kelly. Our guest today is David Hill, the Vice President of Natural Gas Economy Operations at Encana, based here in Denver. Welcome back, David.
Thank you.
And Kelly, this has been, so far, such an interesting conversation and really, you know, something that I don't know a lot about because I'm not an energy person per se. We were talking during break about things, David. It was funny because safety, I think, is one of the things a lot of consumers are really scared about, and the infrastructure thing. And I know we had to go to break before this, but talk about how many stations Encana has here in the Rockies.
Yeah, just total stations in Colorado, natural gas fueling stations by us and others, there's 32.
Wow.
Which two and a half years ago, there were 22. So we've seen in the last couple of years several stations being built. Encana's built two stations here we have in Colorado. One is currently operating up just north of Fort Lepton, uh-huh. and the second we're under construction right now in Parachute. And we've also helped fund some stations. So we helped fund a station in Rifle so our vehicles could fill up there, and a couple stations we've worked with Weld County commissioners to put a couple stations up in Weld County to help fuel our fleets as well as some of the other producers. So in Colorado, 32. There's probably four or five stations in the different phases of financing and construction. So maybe by the end of this year, we'll see close approaching 40, which is a lot of stations compared to where we were, 100% more.
Well, and a huge investment on Encana's part.
Yeah.
Obviously, you guys are in this for the long haul, because I think you said it's anywhere between a mil to 3 mil to put one of these islands even in a gas station.
Yes, yes.
That's a lot of investment from the Encana organization.
Yeah. I mean, when we looked at this as, is it viable, sustainable, we felt it was. And then management asked to demonstrate it. Go demonstrate this is real. And while we have begun the demonstration phase, we realized it actually is a business. So we're developing a business around this. We're moving downstream into the retail and bulk fuel selling business, where we're offering fueling solutions and fueling logistics to customers, which is something we hadn't even thought about 3 years ago, being in this kind of a business. So it's quite exciting. We see the future is definitely bright for this opportunity in North America. And it's that abundant story that brings that sense of this time around it's going to work, because we're not going to see a shortfall of natural gas. That we've been able to explore and find all this natural gas in this country, why not use it?
Circling back to what Jan started with is the safety issue. So these fueling logistics, one thing that I see in talking to a lot of the people that I talk to is there an issue with the high pressure of natural gas and how safe are these vehicles?
Yeah, and that's a really common question we get with any alternative fuel, is we're very familiar with gasoline, very comfortable with it, but we're not familiar with, say, natural gas. But we don't realize, again, it's in our home. We're around natural gas every day. So people ask about the safety. So when we talk about natural gas, the flammability of natural gas, when I look at all the aspects of fuel, natural gas is actually more safer fuel than diesel or gasoline. So it's more difficult to ignite. It has a very tight amount of oxygen needed. And if you have the right amount of oxygen, you can ignite it. If it doesn't have enough, it's too lean. If it has too much oxygen, it's too rich. So it's safer than gasoline and diesel. It has a lower or higher auto ignition temperature than diesel or gasoline. So the amount of heat needed to ignite it is higher. So it's more difficult to ignite. That's why it's been a tough fuel to put into an engine, because it's hard to make it combust, right? So you need a higher temperature of combustion. So it's safer in that aspect. It's lighter than gasoline. So if you have a diesel or gasoline leak in your garage or in your home or in an accident, it pools. And what catches fire is the vapor, not the liquid. So for gasoline, if you had an incident where it was released, it's lighter than air, then it dissipates and actually blends with the air. So it's harder to ignite it. So it's safer from that aspect in an accidental release or an accident. When you talk about pressure, I think that's a really good question. These are cylinders that are met very strict standards on safety. So they're pressure rated to 2.5 times their rating. So we were talking earlier about CNG being at 3,600 pounds. So those cylinders are tested almost to 10,000 PSI repeatedly until failure. They go through a flammability test. They go through a drop test. They go through actually a gunshot test. What would happen if you have a high-pressure cylinder and a gun is fired at it? Would it explode? That's Hollywood, right?
Right.
Yeah.
It doesn't explode.
Yeah, Hollywood really does a disservice because
it's true. I'm like,
So if you look at the safety record, and when we think about those cylinders, they have to be bolted into the frame of the vehicle. They just aren't laid into your trunk. So our gasoline tanks are plastic or aluminum. We look at these CNG tanks, and they're much heavier, much safer, and they're bolted to the frame. So they actually make the vehicle safer. So the high pressure is the concern, and again, it's been tested. If you look at the long-term safety record of natural gas vehicles in this country, we have very strict standards to build to and install to. Our safety record in natural gas is much more superior than gasoline or diesel.
David, you're talking about the natural gas vehicles, and you mentioned something in the first segment that there are conversion kits or conversion companies that can do this with vehicles. So let's say that I drive a midsize SUV. I don't drive a big Yukon or Tahoe or anything like that, but I don't want to drive a Chevy Volt either. Can I convert mine, and is it easily done?
The quick answer is no to both.
Okay.
And there's a good reason. And again, it's really back to the safety. If you want to convert a vehicle, you have to use an EPA-certified kit. And there are several manufacturers in the country that manufacture EPA-certified kits. And those certified kits are really about the emissions. They're very strict on the emissions of our vehicles in this country for gasoline, propane, anything. Those kits are very expensive to certify, no matter what fuel it is, so they're very limited. So if you want to convert a vehicle, you'd go to the EPA website. They actually have a website that lists the EPA certified kits and who the manufacturer is. So typically, because we're talking about it, it's mainly fleet type vehicles. So vans, work vans, pickup trucks, and sedans.
Not your average consumer vehicle, the fleet type vehicle for the
now.
Sedan. But other than that, it's mostly fleet right now.
Right.
And then, that's the conversion.
Yeah. And then, so we talked about the Honda Civic, is you can buy that from your dealer. But the number one selling vehicle in America is the pickup truck. So those are now available to us as consumers.
And what do they cost? I mean, if I wanted to convert my pickup truck, what does that cost to
you? Yeah, what's it cost? That's a good question. So for us as consumers, that cost can be $9,000 to $12,000 on top of your vehicle. 50%, 60% of that is the cost of the tank to put in. And then it's the certification cost and the installation cost to put on the vehicle. So there's a premium there right now. And there's a premium for all of our alternative vehicles because there are not a lot of them being sold. So the more they get sold, the more that premium comes down. And it's pretty much simple economics there. But we have to let people know about them, get more of them out there, and see that price come down. So it's an expensive proposition. The Honda Civic natural gas has a premium of about $6,500 on top of compared to its natural gas equivalent. So that's when we look, are there incentives out there to help us? And that's what helps increase the adoption of alternative fuel vehicles. So today, federally, there's no vehicle incentives for us for natural gas. There are for electric. In Colorado, we've been a leader in alternative fuels. And Colorado has incentives. And the incentives are being phased out because the right thing to do with incentives is to put them in place and put a sunset on them. mm-hmm. and then see what happens with the market. So today, as a consumer or fleet, in the state of Colorado, we have there's a 35% tax credit you can get back from the state for alternative fuel vehicles. And natural gas, several yes. natural gas vehicles qualify for that. Not a tax attorney, so definitely want to consult your tax professional
yeah, right.
on that, whether you qualify. But it's there, and it's there to help fleets and consumers make that
switch. Make that transition.
Yeah, to
Got
test it.
It.
And so federally, you know, for natural gas vehicles, there are a fuel credit that's available for the companies that dispense the fuel. They just did as tax extenders as we rolled out of the year. And that one of the things that were in the tax extenders bill was a 50-cent credit for all the alternative fuels, ethanol, propane, and natural gas. So that's there at the federal level. So we talked about the home fueler. There's a $1,000 credit from the federal government for a home fueler for natural gas. And so those are the things that are in play right now. But unfortunately, sometimes at the federal level, they pick a fuel. They try to pick
right.
a winner. And I think what we really like to see is a policy that encourages all the alternative fuels.
Right.
You know, a level playing field, then let the market pick. Mm-hmm. You and I pick which fuel we
right.
want. But we do need to increase our domestic use of our own fuels. And it'd be nice to see our government step up and create a level playing field for us as consumers.
Well, talking about that, we talk about governors that are pretty out front on things, and one of them is Chris Christie in New Jersey for solar and his support of a number of different energy industries. And here in Colorado, Governor Hickenlooper has been very supportive of the natural gas industry and has urged creation of these in-state markets for natural gas. What do you foresee happening with Governor Hickenlooper and here in Colorado as far as legislation that would help or even education that would help get the word out?
Well, I think Governor Hickenlooper really stepped up about a year ago with Governor Phelan in Oklahoma.
Oh, right,
and,
yeah.
And did, and I think they did something that was unprecedented where they aren't going to wait on the federal government. They're going to do something about it. And again, it's let's look at our own fleets. So within each of those states, the governors looked at their fleets, and they developed a memorandum of understanding, an MOU. And just those two came together and signed an MOU to say we want to look at, evaluate, and get Detroit to build vehicles for us, natural gas, and we want to implement that in our fleets. Since that time, 22 states have signed on to that MOU.
Oh, wow.
And they've actually put an RFP out over those states, and we're seeing lower cost from Detroit, from our manufacturers. So the vehicle costs are coming down
Great.
When you put a larger, if you will, bid out. So the governor is really stepping up on that forefront. And again, he's looking at the economic and the environmental impact of this fuel. And why aren't we using it in a state that has abundant resources of natural gas?
Right.
So we see that moving forward. And definitely, through the governor's energy office, we're seeing outreach and education for all the alternative fuels. And that's really important, again, is letting people know there's choices. And Colorado can lead. And we are leading, as an example, across the country, whether it's electric vehicles, propane, and natural gas. We're stepping up, and our infrastructure's reflecting that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really exciting.
So yeah, it is exciting.
It is exciting, and we're talking about mostly a local strategy, but you mentioned we need more of a federal strategy,
yeah.
A national strategy around this from our federal lawmakers. And do you foresee, you know, what legislation, I guess, is in play to bring about a larger national discussion? And are they gearing up to create more of a national energy policy for the United States, or will it continue to be this sort of random, locally driven strategy?
Well, it's a tough time.
Yes, it is.
In the country, right?
Right.
From a fiscal
issues
perspective. So tax credits and things that take money away from the Treasury, I think, are tough discussion mm-hmm. items at the federal level. So, and we all have to respect that. You know, we need to balance our budget. We all balance our
yeah.
budgets at our home, so we need to do it at the federal level. So again, I think that what we're asking is more don't pick a winner. You know, as mm-hmm. don't pick a fuel or a policy. Let's pick a policy that's fuel neutral, for example, for transportation, and incentivize the country and the consumers and the fleets to change our fuel behavior through some incentives. So there was a Natural Gas Act in Congress over the last 3 years that never got passed in the Senate and the House, specific to natural gas, trying to emulate what was there for the electric vehicle coalition. but it never got passed. Again, it's a tough time at our federal level to balance. So we'd like to see a national energy policy.
Uh-huh.
That would be nice to see our federal government step forward and do that. It's been a long time since we've had one.
Right.
So that would be a nice thing. Again, thinking about domestic security, you know, the environment, as well as the economy, job creation around a national energy policy.
And how? What's the interplay with the military, our domestic military installations? Is there any push to get them to convert to natural gas? Because that seems like it would be a large market as
Yeah, on the military basis, you can see using natural gas. And there has been a pushback in the early and mid-90s to look at natural gas on a military basis. And several bases did build infrastructure for the vehicles that commute around. When we come to the military, it's getting fuel to our mission and to our operations is very critical.
Right.
And if we have to, so we're looking at liquefied natural gas as an option for them. But diesel seems, and jet fuel still seem to play the role for the military right now in theaters out there.
Right, but that's in the foreign, like forward operating
right.
bases and those. But for our domestic installations, we're looking at more securing our domestic energy supplies and making sure that our facilities keep running in the event of an emergency. And it seems that if we have such a big supply of natural gas, that may be a good transition for us, or no?
Yeah, I think so. It definitely is a good fuel there, especially for the buses and heavy-duty vehicles on the site. You know, electric vehicles moving small amount of people around make a great opportunity on the bases as well. So, you know, again, the electric is a domestic fuel, natural gas is a domestic fuel. We should be looking at that. And post office, some of our government services.
Oh, yeah.
The postal deliveries, right? They follow the same route. They make a great application for alternative fuels. Why can't they be on an alternative fuel? They should be.
Yeah.
So we're seeing, I think, with this administration, a look at through the government to look at those vehicles for alternative fuels. So we're excited to see what might come down the pipe there.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I want to switch gears a little bit, David. A few months ago, we had China Energy in here on the show, and we were talking about some of the foreign direct investment that the Asian countries, especially China, are bringing in here into North America, specifically here in the Rocky Mountain region. There were discussions about looking at our natural gas for potential export into the Asian markets. Can you talk about that a little bit? I mean, it's been a conversation sort of in the background, but what are the implications of that, and what does that mean for us here in the U.S.?
Yeah, and I think that conversation is so new, right, just in the last 5 years. And, you know, 8 years ago, we were building import terminals into our country because we thought we were running out of natural gas. So today, in North America, we have the ability to import 19 BCF a day, which is almost a third of our consumption. So
wow.
We, in the U.S., we consume about we produce and consume about 65 billion cubic feet a day of natural gas. So we thought we were running out of natural gas, so we were like China. We were looking to import it from other countries because
right.
we needed to keep the lights on and the industrial uses and our homes warm. And what happened was we discovered this abundant natural gas in North America. So those import terminals are sitting there idle. We're not using them. We're importing
right.
about a BCF to 1.5 BCF a day to keep the terminals cold. So we have all these idle investments sitting on our coasts. So many of those companies have been looking at turning those facilities around to make them export terminals.
Mm-hmm.
So in the U.S., you have to have federal approval to export natural gas out of the country. So you have to file with the federal government, Department of Energy, and then they review the application. So there's one terminal, proposed terminal, that has been approved in Louisiana. Sabine Pass, which is an import terminal, being turned around to be an export terminal, owned and operated by Cheniere, the company. So they have gotten federal approval to export to countries with the free trade agreement
mm-hmm.
and countries without the free trade agreement. So they have a 20-year license. So now that they have approval, they have to get the financing, which they've done, and they have to get the contracts from countries or power utilities around the world, which they've done. And that plant, that terminal is now under construction
okay.
to do exporting. So that'll be the first terminal. There has been, and that'll do maybe 2 BCF a day, 2 billion cubic feet a day of export.
Okay.
And there have been 6 other proposed terminals that would equal about 12 BCF a day of export that the federal government is now looking at. They haven't been approved, The concern, I think, people have, industrial consumers and others, is what would happen with the price of natural gas if we begin to export the fuel that we have here. And I think that's there's been several studies done looking at the price impact, the elasticity of natural gas with demand, and it's still being evaluated by the federal government, whether they're going to allow one at a time and see how it goes, or they're going to allow these other facilities to be built.
If you had a crystal ball, what do you think might happen in this area?
Well, we don't know. That's just too many uncertainties.
Okay.
But when I read what other people think, I don't study that as my profession. But there are several institutions out there and colleges that have studied that, and they're forecasting 4 to 6 BCF a day of export in the U.S. So right now we've got 2 BCF approved. And so we're seeing countries like Japan and China and Korea, who are net importers of natural gas, looking at the U.S. because we have a very stable political environment as a producer of energy. So they look at us as a safe haven for natural gas versus some of the other countries in the Middle East that also export natural gas.
Sure.
So this has been an amazing conversation. So if there are consumers like myself that are pretty jazzed about natural gas vehicles, what would be the next step for them? How do they, if they want to get involved in the discussion, how would they do that? How can they support Encana's efforts? What would you suggest?
Yeah, there's several ways they could approach it, and I think the first is just get more information. So there's a national website. NGV America has a website, so you can just Google NGV America. I think it's ngva.org. Give you a lot of information about the options and what's going on at the federal level as well, and how to learn more about it. And then at the state level, right here in Colorado, we have a Colorado Natural Gas Vehicle Coalition. It's being run right out of our Clean Cities program here in Denver, the American Lung Association. So they have a website as well. You can reach out and learn more. The second is really from our political level, is reach out to our local congressmen. As well, also at the federal level, let them know that you're interested in using natural gas or alternative fuels here in Colorado, and let them know you want to be a voice, and it should be our voice at the federal and the House level. The other is to talk to the OEMs. Talk to your dealerships. Tell them you're interested. Let them know, because the more questions they get, they'll report back corporately that, hey, we're getting a lot of requests for whatever kind of product it might be, whether it's an SUV, pickup truck, or sedan. The more you ask, the more you engage the conversation, the more that conversation spreads. And there are some local conversion companies here in town. Weld County Garage up in Weld County does conversions. There's a small conversion company called Fuel Tech here in Commerce City that does conversions as well. So just, take control.
Yeah.
If you're really interested, do your research, go out and look for it. You can call Encana and some other fuel providers and find out what the options are. So it's exciting, but it's daunting. It's a lot of information.
Yeah.
So we're really working hard to get our manufacturers to give us options, so we don't have to figure all this out. We can just go to the dealership and say, I'd like that Dodge Ram.
Right. Yeah.
I'd like that in natural gas, please.
Yeah. David Hill, thank you so much for joining us today and for all of the things that Encana is doing in this area. I mean, you're facilitating these very large conversations as well as this movement into natural gas conversion across the board in so many business areas. And I think that's so exciting, and we appreciate you being here. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity to come.
And Kelly, so much fun to always do this show with you. I always gain so much insight on these areas I don't know much about.
Well, yeah, and what it indicates also is that we as consumers, we are moving into an era where we need to be more proactive, and we need to take a look at what we've got a lot of choices, and we want to make good, educated decisions. And so it's really part of the impetus is on us to go out and research these things and talk to a lot of people and have conversations like we have on this show, and really discuss how can we move our economy forward. And two things strike me. One, the American Lung Association is involved in natural gas vehicles. Like, they wouldn't be involved if it wasn't better for us and cutting our emissions and everything. And the job creation, we need that right now.
Yes.
And we need to secure our domestic supplies. So it all wraps up in this neat package, and that I think the future's right now. It's not in the future. It's right now.
It's right now, and there are so many resources and so many ways to engage with organizations like Encana, as well as Rapid Tech Transit that you work with. So again, just to go over this, take action today. There's ngva.org. You can go to encana.com and reach out to them, and they can help you understand where the infrastructure is for your fleet. They can pass on the information for those vendors who can help you transition your fleet vehicles, and all of those things. There's the Colorado Natural Gas Vehicle Coalition. The OEMs and dealers are certainly those great resources that will help you get to that next level, to transition to vehicles. And always, 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 those legislators, both state and federal, are those great resources that will move policy in the direction that we need it, and not just continuously circle in this conversation around traditional fuels. It'll really drive this conversation forward if we engage. And Kelly, as always, RapidTechTransit.com, helping bring new energy solutions to the forefront every single day. So thank you guys so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
You're welcome. Have a great weekend, and join us next week for Driving Force Radio.
You've been listening to Driving Force Radio with ICOSA, hosted by Jan Mazzotti. ICOSA invites you to do something different. Be a driving force. Influence change. Be a leader. Visit us at theicosamagazine.com.